We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover, starting with local. And it appears each week SPD, is Seattle Police Department, is putting out a new video.
It's a viral marketing
campaign. They're trying to get their own spot on YouTube, I guess.
Yeah. This week it was the video of Officer Walsh punching a teenage jaywalker. That was pretty interesting. I mean, I saw the video. I went online, and I think I saw it on the Seattle PI website. I saw the video without sound because I thought that would give me a better idea of the actual dynamics. Often with sound, you're focusing on what people are saying, the words that are going back and forth. But I wanted to see the actions. Because while what people are saying is important, the actions are what really matter.
Yeah, and particularly with de-escalation of conflicts, body language is so important.
Makes a big point makes a big impression, your body language and everything. And what I saw was basically a guy manhandling a woman. And the way that he wrestled with her. Not the woman that he punched, by the way, but the first woman, the 19-year-old, the way that he wrestled with her, shoved her down on the car and leaned on top of her. I have to say, if it were me, I'd be fighting back, too. I saw this and I felt like this guy doesn't just need training in de-escalation. He and probably the rest of the department as well need some training, some sensitivity training when it comes to how to handle women, how to handle teenagers. Every parent who has had a fight with a teenager, with their teenage child, probably sympathizes with him a little bit, but very few parents will go to those lengths to punch their teenage child or to wrestle him down and lay on top of him. You know, I mean, that's just not. You know, I looked at that and I was just like, this is appalling, you know, aside from the fact, you know, certainly there are issues of race involved here, but just the male, female and the adult teenage dynamic was just appalling.
Yeah. And particularly when you take the larger context into consideration, also the fact that there were a number of other friends of these two girls who were converging on the scene. And of course, if for people who are familiar with the area, it's right outside Franklin High School. It's about a half block away. So there's a lot of teenagers milling around. And of course, they're going to be attracted to any kind of a fracas like this. And, you know, the whole idea that this is how you control a situation like that, it really speaks to the training of the officer. And particularly because we've seen other incidents that weren't exactly like this, but also spoke to the training of the officers and how they view the public and how they view the people they interact with and the disrespect with which they view them. It's really very, very troubling. And it has implications also for the police chief search.
Yeah. Well, also too, there have been a number of audits of complaints against the police department for the improper use of force, and those audits over the last 6 years, four different reports have cited that the Seattle Police Department staff have a history of letting minor infractions turn into these escalate into these use of force situations, things like jaywalking or you know, things where you would ordinarily give a person a warning or a ticket, often, too often, turn into these escalations and use of force and then generate a complaint to the police department. So pretty clearly, it's not just a problem with one or two officers. It's a problem with the department. And as Jobs said, yeah, it is turning into these calls for reopening the search for a new police chief. What I found interesting about this is that this comes after one of the three final candidates withdrew from consideration. He probably got a better offer. Rick Brazil, I hesitate to say it, but it's true, the one white guy of the three candidates.
No, I was going to go there.
Yeah, and as it turns out, some folks, and this includes a majority of the members of the city council, are calling for a reopening of the search process. I find that kind of discriminatory. They have a good candidate there, Ron Davis, and he is the candidate that I liked the best. And he is clearly the favorite of the mayor, and it is the mayor's decision to make. And I find it disturbing that the city council is now telling the mayor, well, we don't think he's good enough.
Well,
when there were city council members who sat on the search committee.
The dynamic here, and let's be clear, there are about, three dozen people who think it's their birthright to run Seattle. By and large, they have for the past 30 or so years. And these folks really wanted the interim chief, John Diaz, because he won't rock the boat. He's an establishment guy. And they are perceiving that vis-a-vis Davis, he's no longer a viable candidate because of this incident, the incident with the Mexican suspect in April, with that video. It's just been a string of bad, they're not concerned about the actual incidents, they're concerned about the PR, that it's bad PR for the department and it looks badly on him. So they don't think that he's a viable candidate at this point, and they don't want Davis. They don't want the candidate who has a track record of working with non-white communities.
Really disturbing.
That's extremely disturbing because
that's what Seattle needs, really.
It's what Seattle needs, but it also really speaks to the power dynamic of the people who, behind closed doors like to think that they run Seattle, mm-hmm. and how they view the rest of us.
Yeah.
And how they view the rest of us is basically the way the officer in question viewed those two teenagers. Now, there were a couple other pieces of that particular incident that don't speak to the larger issues but are worth noting also. They're not directly related, but they've been conflated in a lot of the accounts of this. One is the very peculiar Seattle obsession with ticketing jaywalkers. But the other piece is that particular intersection actually is a really dangerous intersection, and why the city does not have barriers up that force people to use the overhead pass is a mystery to me, because it is a dangerous place to cross the street, and they don't have any barriers up the way you would expect them to in a situation like that would prevent the students from a high school a half block away from actually trying to dash across the street.
Yeah, why would they spend money to erect barriers when they can collect money with jaywalking tickets?
That's a very cynical outlook. I'm shocked. I'm shocked at you for having that cynical analysis.
Well,
that's a synonym for cynical.
I've heard from people that cross that area, and mm-hmm. using the overhead takes a significantly much longer period of time.
Yes, it
to
does.
Do
it
so.
Does,
where
yes.
if you just dash across traffic, which is highly dangerous, but you're across the street in a matter of seconds. So.
Yeah.
Assuming you're not going over somebody's
head. And
hey,
when I was a teenager, I was all about instant gratification.
Yeah.
So
that would tell me something, that maybe there ought to be something that's more convenient for the flow of human traffic, for foot traffic rather than the flow of car traffic there. Something on street level, not something that makes you take a major detour up and over.
Yeah, that's true too.
All right. All right, moving on. It is June and time for mid-year budget reviews.
Yeah, the mayor came out and announced his mid-year budget cuts to the city's general fund. He announced cuts that would fill an $11.7 million shortfall. And this kind of caught my eye because the article in the Seattle Times had a headline that said, the mayor is cutting hours at the waiting pools in Seattle. and I looked at that and I thought, that's a terrifically uninspiring headline, so there must be something in there that I should take a look at,
The mayor is picking on little kitties.
Yes, what are they hiding, So I went to the mayor's website and I took a look at his budget announcement, because usually, the mayor, this is standard policy, the mayor puts up his, a summary of whatever changes they're making to the budget. Whatever proposed changes or actual changes. And these mid-year budget revisions, he can actually make those changes without having the council approve them. So I thought, okay, I better look at these, right? So I went up and I looked at them. And first of all, my first response to them was that, there's nothing worse than having to read 20 pages of PowerPoint slides where everything is on 50-point type.
Lose the PowerPoint.
Yeah, lose the PowerPoint slides. I thought, I'm okay with reading two or three pages of budget stuff. Just please don't make me read this huge type, But other than...
Maria's a small print kind of woman.
I'm a small print person. I like to read the small print,
The fine print.
So anyway, that really annoyed me. But then when I actually looked at the content, what I found was interesting. I found, because usually they tell you, okay, here's the problem on the revenue side. We didn't bring in, $11.7 million that we expected, and this is why. And in there, there was a line item called $5 million in expenditure risks. And I looked at that, and I looked for a footnote, and I looked for more explanation, and there was no explanation of what $5 million in expenditure risks actually means. And that accounts for almost half the hole in the budget. So I found that extremely disturbing. I wanted to see, okay, what the heck are expenditure risks? But then I thought, okay, let me just look at the cuts side and see if those are equally vague too. Well, it just gives the overall percentage of cuts in each department. Doesn't really tell you a lot of detail either. I would have liked to see more detail as well. But what I found is that the cuts look pretty even over all of the departments, with the exception of the housing department, which takes a 16.6% cut. And I really wanted to see what the detail of that was. My guess is that it's probably cutting money that the city was going to provide in assistance to people who are struggling with their mortgages, or people who are looking to buy their home, buy a new home, something that would, you know, help the housing market. That's my guess, but I don't know that for sure because there was no detail provided. It would be nice to see whether that money that's being cut is for that, you know, additional funding that was going to be provided to prop up the housing market, or whether it was cut from programs for example, assistance for renters or people who are having trouble with their landlords or something like that. I would have liked to see some detail there. But all the other departments, it looks like he spread the cuts out pretty evenly, with the exception, of course, of the police department, which gets the smallest cut. Basically, their cuts was a matter of taking money back that would have been used to hire an additional 21 officers that the city council had mandated. So basically just not filling open positions. But in addition to that, the other question that I had was the Seattle Department of Transportation internal fund shows a shortfall of $6.6 million. And when it talks about where that shortfall comes from, I noticed that half of it was related to dealing with the snowstorm and quote unquote homeless encampment cleanups. And I just looked at that and I shook my head and I just thought, okay, over $3 million for dealing with the snowstorm and promoting Greg Nichols and pursuing, you know, Greg Nichols' crusade against the homeless. That's just outrageous. That is outrageous.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to the whole waiting pools issue, and specifically the issue with the Seattle Times. This is not a new observation that since the demise of the print PI, the Times has become much more political and much more biased in its reporting, in its front page coverage in particular. But, I mean, you know, at this point, once Tim Burgess announces his campaign for mayor, I think he really should be required to, you know, deduct the cost of the Seattle Times newsroom as an in-kind contribution, because they, you know, if you want to get a sense of what those three dozen people who think they run Seattle are thinking at any given time, just look at the front page of the Seattle Times these days. You know, the attack against McGinn for trying to make responsible cuts to the budget, the attack against, you know, somehow McGinn trying to find a police chief that would fix the problems with the police department, you know, becomes anonymous sources leaking that the city council wants to reopen the investigation. The whole thing with the anti-panhandling ordinance and their crusade against that. The Times really has become the dispenser of conventional wisdom from the powers that be in this city, and it's very, very discouraging to see that nakedly become a propaganda organ of a relatively small but influential group of people.
Yeah. And then they don't even look at the details and ask any serious questions about, okay, what is in here?
No, they're being advocates. They're not being reporters.
Yeah. They're there strictly to you know, say we think McGinn is terrible. Look, he can't even, you know, even when he makes what I generally think were probably the best cuts he could do in this kind of environment. They can't even do that. They can't even say, oh, look, you know, cuts that are not going to have that big of an impact on you. You know, he's actually doing a decent job as a mayor. They can't do that. They have to go, oh, he's picking on little kids.
And you know that if he had not made those cuts, they would have attacked him for that, too.
Yes, that's true.
All right. Let's move on to national and developments with the continuing oil disaster in the Gulf.
Oh, yeah. This week we learned that the estimate of the leak has now doubled. it to 60,000 barrels
again.
Per day. Doubled again, yeah. And I should note, too, for folks, that the Coast Guard knew on the first day of the leak, just to remind folks that we've said this before, the Coast Guard knew on the first day that the leak might be as high as 64,000 barrels per day. That means
that's when people were told it was 1,000.
Yes, that's when the Coast Guard itself said, "Oh, it didn't appear to be the official line was it didn't appear to be any oil leaking from the well." And British Petroleum or BP said, "Well, we think it's about 1,000 barrels per day." Well, now it's up to 60,000. What I find very interesting about that is this means that now the earlier estimate of 30,000 barrels per day, which we talked about last week, was made before the riser pipe was cut so that BP could put a cap over it and siphon some of the oil off. So my question is, if cutting the pipe approximately doubled the rate of the leak, then why the heck did the government allow BP to do that? They should have taken the advice of many scientists who said, don't cut the pipe because we think it is holding back quite a bit. And if you cut the pipe, it's going to make the leak not just 20% larger, as BP was saying, but much larger, perhaps a magnitude of order larger than it was. Well, here we go. It doubled. So, yeah, it looks like the scientists knew what they were talking about. BP was hiding something. Do you think maybe the government could have figured that out? You know,
particularly when some of those scientists work for that government.
Yeah. I just find that incredible. So of course, as BP continues to deny, you know, that the leak was as bad as it clearly was in the beginning, And also what I found interesting, too, is where the new numbers came from. Again, the new number of 60,000 barrels per day came from BP sending a new probe down there over the weekend, last weekend, to measure the actual rate of flow. And my thought, too, was, okay, if they could do that, why didn't they do that, you know, from day one? Why did they wait until after they'd already put a cap on there and it clearly wasn't collecting all the oil? Then they send a probe down to measure the rate of flow? Oh, geez. I mean, that in itself should be grounds for a lawsuit.
What this really adds up to, and I think this explains a lot of the behavior of BP, is that they are far more concerned about legal liability than they are environmental damage or economic damage to the Gulf or the adjacent Gulf states.
Yeah, and that's clearly true when the reps for five major oil companies testified before Congress this week, and they presented their plans for what they would do in case of an oil spill, and the plans were exactly identical. They were approximately identical, and they were all drawn up by the same small company in Houston. The company's name is Response Group. Response Group, yeah, that is the name of the company.
They spent a lot of time focus grouping that one.
Yeah, it kind of sounds a little bit like a company that would have maybe two employees in Houston and then a P.O. box in the Cayman Islands, you know. And that's what you get that's the sense you get when you look at the oil response plans. Apparently, they're all exactly identical, and they all refer to things that and these are supposedly drawn up for the Gulf of Mexico. They all refer to things like the impact of oil spill on walruses and sea lions, you know, Arctic creatures that don't live in the Gulf of Mexico. So clearly, these five major oil companies have no plan for what to do in the event of a major oil spill like this. It's not just BP that is the bad guy here. It's the whole industry.
Although if the oil spill continues at the rate it's going, eventually that oil will reach the Arctic.
Well, what this tells you actually is that those response plans were not serious response plans. They were fulfilling a legal obligation.
Yeah.
And this raises the question again of where was the government? Because somebody in an oversight agency sort of looked at those response plans and looked at the references to sea lions and walruses and said, this is not adequate. This is not a real response plan.
Well, the minerals management, association did that. They looked at the response plans and they rubber stamped them. I'm sure it took them about a half a minute to do that because clearly they didn't read them and they weren't doing any kind of oversight.
I don't know. It doesn't take 30 seconds to use a rubber stamp, but
that's
yeah.
True. it may to use a rubber stamp and then write out your signature if you're not used to actually writing.
Well, you have a secretary to do that. The other thing that I wanted to mention about the oil spill this week was the $20 billion escrow account that Obama mentioned in his otherwise meaningless Tuesday night television address. That has actually attracted a lot of criticism from Republicans who are bemoaning that, you know, poor BP is being forced to cough up this $20 billion to the big onerous government as an escrow account. Well, no, the escrow account money isn't going to the government. It's going to the beleaguered people of the Gulf who are being affected by the damages to their livelihoods and to the environment in that area. But above and beyond that, $20 billion sounds like a lot of money. But two things here. Number one is if you compare it to quarterly profit, and we talked last week about BP's going ahead continuing to consider issuing dividends, even in the response of all this. BP has a lot of cash, and this is not a significant expenditure for them. But above and beyond that, the share price, as a result of the additional certainty in terms of legal exposure that was attached to BP because of their agreeing to this fund, their stock price actually went up the following couple of days, and they got that value back. That actually made money for them to agree to that that escrow account.
Yep.
So you know, if that's the case, I think they should probably add another $40 or $60 billion to that fund and see how much more their stock price can go up.
Well, $20 billion is just the about quarterly profits from last year. Didn't they make $78 billion last year?
No. Last year their profit after all their expenses and they paid dividends and everything was $17 billion. So if they suspend the dividend, then that tells you, you know, that $20 billion really is a drop in the bucket for them.
Yep.
All right. Let's move on then to international, starting with Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, Kyrgyzstan, we heard a little bit probably in the news. Everyone probably heard a little bit in the news this week about the violence in Kyrgyzstan. It's always played up as ethnic violence. Really, it's political violence when you look at it closely. It was elements of the Kyrgyz military, including some militia members and police who attacked the civilian population of the southern city of Osh. And they didn't just attack the Uzbek minority. They also burned homes and businesses of members of the Kyrgyz minority as well. What it clearly was some kind of a political attack to undermine the new central government in the Kyrgyz capital. And what was interesting, too, is the new interim government is saying that supporters of the former Kyrgyz president, Bakayev, were responsible for this, particularly elements of the military that don't support the new government. But it looks to me like it was coordinated so well that it makes you wonder if there wasn't some outside help to bring all these sides together. The military, the police don't generally tend to communicate that and coordinate that well with militia groups.
But who would have experience doing something like that?
Yeah. So you might ask the question of, you know, with Russia supporting the new interim government and the U.S. having been a major supporter of the former president Bakayev and both countries having military bases in Kyrgyzstan, you might ask the question, which one of the two whose MO does this sound like, you know, support rogue elements of the military to try to overthrow a government you don't like? Sounds very much like something that the U.S. government has supported in the past.
Yeah. Although, as we all know, Obama would never do anything like that.
Oh, no.
All right. Moving on to Afghanistan.
Yeah, very curious episode in the news the beginning of the week where the New York Times in a front page article announced that Afghan had nearly $1 trillion of mineral wealth that had never been discovered before. Was I mentioned on Counterspin before this program? That's been known for a long time. Those geological surveys were based on previous geological surveys that led the Bush administration in 2007 to declare that Afghan's mineral wealth should be essentially the basis for U.S. policy there. Those surveys in turn were done based on Soviet surveys from the mid-80s, which basically concluded the same thing for the Soviet Union.
Yeah,
so
hello.
The question then becomes, why now? And the reason why now is that public support for the Afghan war at a time when at a time when there have been a lot of setbacks in the field, is flagging. And this tells you a couple things. Number one, the whole idea that the Pentagon thinks that the fact that the public could perceive there being mineral wealth there as a reason to support the war, well, naturally, we should just go and steal the mineral wealth. It doesn't belong to the Afghans. It belongs to us. That's a pretty depressing commentary in itself. But the other interesting thing about this was the reporter who actually wrote the front page story for the New York Times, a guy named James Risen, who won a Pulitzer Prize in for his reporting in 2005 about the Bush administration's warrantless spying policies. Now, this has been pointed to by a number of commentators as evidence that that Risen is pure and that this is not could not possibly be a politically motivated story. But what people have forgotten was that that warrantless spying story was sat on by Risen and the New York Times for over a year until after George Bush was reelected in 2004. Then it was published. So the whole idea that Risen and the New York Times wouldn't be willing to wait on a story until it was politically expedient or useful for the government in order to publish it, that's just not borne out by their track record.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Somalia.
Yeah, there was a big brouhaha this week about child soldiers in Somalia. The U.S. supports the Somali government with money, arms, and training, and it turns out that it isn't just the Muslim militias that scoop up and hire child soldiers in Somalia. It's also the Somali government, which has children as young as 9 years old as members of their military. And that means that because the U.S. supplies money, arms, and training, that U.S. trainers probably have seen these 9-year-old children being trained and serving in the Somali government, military. So, that created a big brouhaha in Washington, D.C. The story was printed in the New York Times. It was interesting. A New York Times reporter went to Somalia, interviewed a couple child soldiers, talked to some NGOs and humanitarian groups there, and it became a big story. The question I have is, okay, so you got this one story about the U.S. supporting a government that press gangs children into the military. What about all the other non-governmental fighting forces in Africa that the U.S. government supplies money to that we don't know about?
Not money, but CIA training. And the Congo conflict has been particularly notorious for this, but also some of the ones in Western Africa where the U.S. has been heavily involved, and U.S. companies that have their own mercenary armies mm-hmm. have been heavily involved mm-hmm. because of the mineral wealth there.
Yeah. So it'd be nice to read some stories about that too.
All right, just a couple minutes left. The London School of Economics.
Yeah, the London School of Economics released a report this week that said the Pakistani Inner Services Intelligence Agency supports the Taliban insurgency now today. And not something that they used to do in the past, but they support the Taliban now and today. I'm just going to read a couple quotes. One of the quotes that appalled me said that, quote, interviews with 9 insurgent field commanders who say that ISI operatives sit in on meetings of the Taliban Leadership Council, often known as the Quetta Shura, which consists of a dozen or so members and meets several times a year in and around the Pakistani southwestern city of Quetta. Afghan security officials and an advisor to the Afghan government working on persuading members of the Taliban to reconcile with the Afghan government have also said that ISI agents are known to sit in on the Quetta Shura meetings as observers. So you got Pakistani, you know, intelligence guys regularly sitting in on Afghan Taliban leadership meetings. Another quote said, quote, the report says several Taliban commanders received training in large madrasa complexes in Pakistan from Pakistani military and ISI agents. So you have Pakistani ISI agents, according to the London School of Economics, actually training Taliban leadership in madrasas in Pakistan. So that's pretty damning, I think. And it should give us some idea of what we're actually fighting when we're in Afghanistan. We're not fighting just a bunch of guys running around with a few AK-47s. We're fighting another government, literally.
And a government that we're paying a lot of money to.
Yeah, we are literally funding both sides of the conflict.
All right. Events.
Yeah. By the way, there's a couple of stories we didn't get to, but they are on the new Ethos State blog. at ethestate.org, WikiLeaks, and the International Criminal Court. The Fremont Fair is going on this weekend, so the solstice parade. Believe it or not, we are close to summer solstice. There's no evidence outside right now, but there is there is a parade going on today,
so
at noon.
Brave the rain and come and see us.
Exactly. And then Tuesday night at 7:30 at Town Hall, Christopher Hitchens will be in town to have a conversation with Luke Burbank. That ought to be interesting, so check that out Tuesday at 7:30.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State's last official regularly printed print edition is coming out this week, so snap it up. We also have our new website, and as I mentioned, the blog that is at www.eatthestate.org, and we are regularly updating stories there. Well, I wouldn't quite say 24/7, but pretty frequently, so check it out.